Against the Grain. It's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism, as the popular observation goes. But, according to Betsy Hartman, that's an especially American outlook. I'll speak with her about what she calls the America syndrome, the national propensity toward apocalyptical thinking rooted in religiosity and imperial expansion. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. The late historian Howard Zinn wrote that to be hopeful in dark times is not just foolishly romantic. It's based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. In the America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness, Betsy Hartman argues that in a world beset by the very real horrors of nuclear weapons and global warming, on terrible display with Hurricane Harvey, we need to avoid the pull of doomsaying in the interest of building a better world. For apocalyptical thinking, she suggests, is a particularly American phenomenon, born of Christianity and empire. Hartman is Professor Emerita of Development Studies and Senior Policy Analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. Betsy, between economic meltdowns and climate change, it's hard not to feel like we're living through unusually apocalyptical times. Are they exceptionally apocalyptic in your view?
Well, I think we've lived through times that were even more apocalyptic, like the Cold War, for example. But certainly it's a very difficult political time in the country with Trump in the leadership and denying climate change. And then, of course, the nuclear standoff with North Korea. I mean, there are plenty of things to feel apocalyptic about, but that doesn't mean we should. We should certainly feel concerned and do something about them, but it doesn't mean we should think it's the end of the world. And of course, now also with the hurricane in Houston and this massive flood, I think that also gives rise to a sense of doom, too.
Sure. You start your book by describing your own history, coming of age in the late 1960s. What was the sense in the air at that time?
Well, there was a sense that the world could end any day in a nuclear conflagration. And I grew up under the shadow of the atomic bomb. And that led, one of the interesting things about doing this book is I explored some of that nuclear history and also looked at people like Robert J. Lifton, who wrote about its impact on our psychology. And I think, you know, for my generation, I was coming of age in the 60s. It was both a heady and hopeful time in terms of the civil rights movement, the women's movement, the anti-war movement. I mean, a lot was shifting in the country. There was a lot positive going on. But at the same time, we had the specter of nuclear war. And certainly in my case, I became part of the Back to the Land movement. There was kind of a survivalist ethos in that, wanting to escape kind of the military-industrial complex and the depredations of civilization and lead a more, you know, holistic and socialistic life. So I think, you know, there was a strange mix in a way, and I talk about this in the book, some of our kind of millennial yearnings that we wanted the world to be a much better place, and we were hopeful that things could turn around overnight through revolution, or, you know, lifestyle changes, or we could totally reject what had come before.
You're suggesting in your book, The America Syndrome, that sense of a world sort of spinning out of control, of the sense that the world could end, is not particular to the late 20th century and the early 21st century, that in fact it has quite deep roots in American history. Can you tell us about those roots, which you write about fairly extensively, and how they have helped shape the ways that we see things in the United States today?
Right. Well, I wrote a chapter on the Puritan legacy because I felt it was important to investigate. And it's fascinating reading Puritan history and learning more about the mindset of the people who came over. A couple of things come to mind. First, of course, is American exceptionalism and the idea that, you know, the Puritans viewed themselves as a chosen people coming to America to serve as a beacon of light to all Christendom. And they needed to be a perfect model, in a way, for the rest of the world. At the same time, they had an apocalyptic predisposition. And when things started going wrong during different periods of time, they would often read those things as signs of the impending apocalypse. There was also a sense that, in a way, you could never be good enough. And I talk about this in the book too, our kind of search for purity. The idea Puritans believed, you know, it was predestined whether you would go to heaven or hell, so that you didn't really know till you were on your deathbed which direction you were going. So you could work tremendously hard, be righteous, do everything, you know, to be a good religious person, and it didn't mean that you would necessarily go to heaven. So that kind of paranoia and anxiety that also sets root with the America syndrome. I also talk about the Puritans' expansionism, the way they came to occupy the land, and of course the wars with Native Americans, and the views of themselves as a chosen people and those who had inhabited the land previously as unchosen. That war, in a sense, was justified by their providential mission. And I think that sense of providential mission is passed down through decades of American history, and it justifies whatever actions are necessary in order to fulfill that providential mission. One other thing I talk about with the Puritans is their use of sermonizing as a political tool on election days and other important days. Puritan leaders would deliver these Jeremiads, which would chastise the community for, you know, their sinful ways and falling away from their mission. But if only we would redeem ourselves, we could fulfill the promise of America. And I think we see these Jeremiads in political usage on both the right and the left in the United States continuing up today, and the kind of susceptibility to the sermonizing. Sermons were, in fact, the major form of literature distributed in the colonies for a long time. And I think we're very susceptible to those kinds of messages.
How does the United States compare to other advanced industrial countries in terms of this sense of impending apocalypse? Because of course we're all facing the threats of global warming, the dangers of a nuclear era that hasn't come to an end, and so on.
Right. Well, partly I wrote this book to try to understand why Americans seem so much more apocalyptic. I mean, I've lived in England and I've lived in South Asia and, done political work, feminist political work with people from many different countries. And it seems to me, and I can't say this absolutely scientifically, although polls tend to show that Americans are more apocalyptic and believe that the end of the world is coming than people in other industrialized countries. So that led me to, you know, ask why. You know, I mean, for example, climate change is an urgent issue. It's extremely serious in terms of its impact on people and nature. And yet, you know, when you go to some place like Germany or Denmark, people are getting on with the business of transitioning to alternative energies in a much more kind of practical way than the United States, partly because we've had such a strong climate denialist lobby. But there's kind of a sense that we can solve this problem together, as opposed to, oh my God, it's going to be the end of the world.
But could that partially be that politicians in the United States really haven't moved to address climate change in the way that steps have been taken, say, in Denmark?
Yes, absolutely. But I think we do have this apocalyptic predisposition in any case. And another reason for it, I believe, is that we are, you know, the world's military superpower. And the book investigates a lot the role of militarism in shaping our mindset. For, you know, just to give an example, The Pentagon has produced kind of worst case scenarios about climate change and conflict. And too often people accept these worst case scenarios as a given, that this is what the future is going to look like because the military says so. And the military itself might actually be producing a multiple, you know, different scenarios. But the worst case ones are the ones that kind of get picked up and believed in. And I think there's a gullibility for these worst case scenarios that are presented not only by the Pentagon, but of course, you know, by the Trump administration. And people believe that because they're, you know, predisposed to believe it and predisposed to believe that war is inevitable. And I think when you live in such a heavily militarized country, not only in terms of interventions overseas, but a very highly militarized police, that's only going to get worse under Trump, and immigration enforcement apparatus. When you live in a place where the military dominates politics so much and certainly dominates expenditures and dominates in many ways the media, you get that kind of war mindset, and I think that's it affects us more than we know. I think to live in a country that's in a state of permanent war and the most powerful military country on the planet.
Do you think there are political implications of that? That when people are told that the only way to deal with the kinds of disruption that climate change is going to bring, and clearly climate change is already bringing major disruption societally to people around the world, and including in the United States, but by framing it a certain way and by having a mindset that war is inevitable, do you think that then makes people much more acquiescent to solutions that might be proffered that are militarized, you know, that we need to militarize the border to keep climate refugees out, for example?
Absolutely. And I've been actually quite disturbed by even many progressives buying into this idea that there are going to be these climate wars and, you know, for example, that the people fleeing from the Middle East or Africa are climate refugees. I think we need to look really carefully at those kinds of narratives. And as you say, there are going to be disruptions and there are disruptions already. But the kind of militaristic assumption is that people will fight each other in these situations. And it's often based on kind of a racialized narrative of poor people of color, especially poor Africans, fighting over scarce resources. And that's then projected onto climate change. And the idea that people necessarily fight in times of environmental stress instead of cooperate, I think is wrong. I mean, there are examples of people cooperating in times of environmental stress. For example, what we're seeing in Houston right now, what you see often in times of environmental stress among pastoral communities in Africa is people actually come together to cooperate over water resources rather than fight over them. And when they do fight, it's often because of a breakdown of institutions, partly from interventions from, you know, external actors for example, top-down state interventions or even interventions by militaries. So I think, you know, I don't want to read human nature as it's all great and, you know, in times of stress, people are just always wonderful. Absolutely not. But people are complicated and there's a long history of cooperation. So if we by this military view that the world's going to descend into a kind of chaos, I think we're really doing ourselves a disservice and also doing a disservice to the people most vulnerable to climate change. And one thing I'd just like to say about this climate refugee kind of discourse is that certainly there will be, and there already is, climate-related migration. Most researchers say it's within national borders or likely to be within national borders, not so much across them, and that it can be also temporary, you know, that you flee from a particular event and then return to your home. And whether or not people migrate permanently has to do with so many factors, including possibilities of alternative livelihoods. So that the idea for that people are going to be streaming across international borders is really a problematic one. And I was quite distressed to see Syria portrayed as a climate war, for example, and climate, you know, when there was a big refugee crisis in Europe, the idea that those people coming toward Europe on boats from Syria and other places were somehow climate refugees, when really, you know, Syria is a deeply political war, and these are political refugees, they are war refugees. And to naturalize these conflicts and blame them on climate change seems to me we're really, you know, excuse the metaphor, missing the boat and really doing a disservice to refugees.
Well, it seems complicated, too, by the fact that at least for some people, people particularly in the United States who might be arguing against those who are climate deniers, to say that climate is having social effects around the world is an argument that people feel is an important one to make. But I think you're saying that by doing so in a very simplistic way, you miss all of the societal upheaval that may be pre-existing, and obviously in the case of war, the actual war, and having a simplistic way of viewing these events, which erases all the history and inequalities of an area.
Absolutely, you know, and I think we need to look at, you know, whether or not, for example, a particular community or members of a particular community can adapt to climate change or deal with a disaster often has so much to do with pre-existing social inequalities, whether they be gender, race, class, etc. So that, you know, you map climate change onto inequality, and certainly those who are already the most vulnerable are likely to be the worst affected. And so rather than kind of fearing that, I think one needs to show greater empathy and solidarity with those people. And I should also say that looking at climate change, this is kind of apocalyptic war lens, distracts us from looking at some of the real battles that are happening now, for example, green grabs in Africa, as biofuel companies want to take over more and more land. Also, land is being bought up for food production by big industrial agricultural firms. And where are the windmills going to be sited? I mean, there's going to be battles over those kinds of things. And in a way, that may be where the real conflicts come in, kind of the political economy of energy investments. And our marginalized communities, our indigenous peoples, land, is that going to be taken? We need to be looking at those kinds of things, not at those people fighting each other just because the weather is bad, which is unfortunately a very popular narrative.
That's the voice of Betsy Hartman. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse War and Our Call to Greatness. I'm Sasha Lilly, and you're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So returning to the Americanness of apocalypticism, I wonder if you can tell us why you think America and the way, both in terms of elites, but also the larger population, buys into these apocalyptical lenses to view our times. To what degree is this linked to the religiosity of America in contrast to comparable countries? And to what degree does it have secular roots?
Right. Well, I think, you know, there are deep religious roots in terms of the Puritans and evangelical Christianity, certainly. And then with the founding, you know, of the United States, our founding fathers were more like deists than, you know, Christians, in the sense that they believed that kind of, you know, that God was guiding the mission, right? And that we had a God-given mission, the new United States. So, you know, whether it's explicitly Christian or it's this more deist belief in a kind of God overlooking everything, or in more secular forms, the kind of biblical book of Revelation, I think, has a role to play here. You know, sometimes I read the narratives about war, climate change, whatever, and they so much seem to and kind of the destruction of nature and life on Earth. You know, sometimes they feel like there's like a direct line between, even in the secular kind of doomsday environmental narratives, a direct line to the Book of Revelation. And I think the Book of Revelation has affected us all in many, many ways. The belief, especially, that war is inevitable. So I think they're both secular manifestations and religious manifestations, and the U.S., you know, the kind of borderline between secular and religious is very fuzzy indeed. You know, some people call what we have a civil religion that is based kind of on Christian values without being explicitly Christian, but a belief in kind of our providential mission and that we are the chosen people permeates American culture and American history up through today. So whether we're secular or not, I think we need to investigate where those ideas are coming from and how they influenced, you know, politics on left, right, and center.
Well, you touched on this briefly earlier, but what does the role of the United States as an imperial power, how has that shaped this discourse that tends towards apocalypticism?
Right. Well, certainly, you know, apocalypticism has many sides, but there are two main ones. One is kind of the belief like the end of the world is coming, you know, it's doomsday. The other is this kind of belief in the millennium, that the New Jerusalem at the end of the Book of Revelation, that all will be set right, you know, Christ will return to earth, or everything's just going to be perfect, you know, we're going to achieve a perfect society. So you have this kind of push and pull between the two. And certainly U.S. imperialism, you know, use kind of the millennial mission, has used and continues to use this idea of the U.S. as the world redeemer. You know, Wilson, President Wilson said, you know, the U.S. needs to make the world safe for democracy, et cetera, et cetera. So this idea that we somehow are the stewards of the planet, of the world, we are the guarantors of peace, that we are going to redeem the world through our democracy, that our values are superior to others. They're part of the imperial package.
And all of those threads that you've just mentioned, one can see right now with Donald Trump. Now, obviously, none of it, as you're saying, started with him. But to what degree do you feel like he pulls these threads together in a most forceful way?
Yeah, forceful is a nice way to put it. Yeah. I mean, in a way, he represents some of the worst aspects of this kind of thinking, right? And that we are good, you know, and they are bad. You know, part of this America syndrome that I talk about is this idea that there's kind of these, you know, simple dualisms between good and bad, you know, chosen and unchosen. So he's really playing on that, you know, they're the good people and the bad people. We are the good country. We are, you know, America first. We are the greatest, you know. And, you know, of course, even Hillary Clinton said, you know, Donald Trump said he was going to make us great again. And Hillary Clinton said we were already great. But this idea that we're great, you know, Trump is really beefing up. And anybody who says we're not great or wait a minute here, you're suddenly bad, you know. So, you know, he's reinforcing, I think, all the kind of worst aspects of American culture and also our incredible provincialism, you know, and of course, withdrawing from the Paris Climate Accord, destroying many aspects of the State Department. I mean, there's just a provincialism that is not good for Americans, not good for the country.
As we've seen recently in Charlottesville, there exists a far right in this country, which didn't come about with Trump, but certainly is being, in many ways, encouraged by Trump. How do you see these ideas that you've mentioned of the coming apocalypse, of American exceptionalism, as it manifests itself on the very far right, the explicitly white supremacist right, the fascist right?
Right. Well, of course, you know, their reading of a multicultural, multiracial United States is in a certain way an apocalyptic one. It's the end of the world, of course, end of their world. And they're wanting to see kind of a all-white paradise again. So there's a kind of millennial aspect to their work, too. But it kind of casts in sharp relief, I think, the white supremacist you know, the persistence of racism in this country and the persistence of who's chosen and who is unchosen, and also the persistence of a kind of white Protestantism. I don't want to brand all Protestants this way, but it's kind of the white Protestant ideal, that male ideal that is the white supremacists are holding up. And all others kind of fall out of it. Even Catholics often fall out of it, Jewish people especially, and of course people of color, and of course also those considered sexually deviant. So there's kind of a real ugly form of American exceptionalism. It's kind of an American white right-wing exceptionalism that takes its ugliest form in these groups and in what happened in Charlottesville.
You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly, and today I'm speaking with Betsy Hartman. She's the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. That's published by Seven Stories Press, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. She's Professor Emerita of Development Studies and Senior Policy Analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. So one place where there has been a fairly long history of apocalyptic thinking has been around population and the idea of resource scarcity. I wonder if you could trace for us the origins of these ideas, which then have had enormous influence on both policy and even on activism in the U.S. and beyond.
Right. I devote a chapter in my book to population issues, partly because that's really been my main focus during my career. And I look back, you know, to the Reverend Thomas Malthus in England and his view that, population growth outstrips food production and resources. And you look back from there and see how that particular ideology, became part of the colonial mission. But then you look, this overpopulation ideology in the United States became particularly popular in the 1960s, when you have people like Paul Ehrlich, the Stanford biology professor, producing the population bomb. And the view that, you know, overpopulation, and before that, in the 40s, also you had writers like William Vogt writing about, how war and famine and all these things are going to occur from too many people, especially in the global South. So we have a long, history of this kind of thinking from the British, Malthus on up. But it really takes off in the 60s in terms of its impact on the environmental movement, the U.S. environmental movement, this idea that overpopulation is destroying the planet, causing scarcity, and that apocalypse is going to happen, famine, water shortages, the earth is going to be totally degraded. Now, of course, many bad things were happening to the environment at the same time. But the idea that it was too many people, especially too many people in the global South, causing these problems became almost a basic credo of the U.S. environmental movement. And if you look back in time, also post-war in the United States, post-World War II, population also in the global South started becoming identified as a threat because it could give rise to communism if development didn't happen enough. So you had this kind of Cold War view of overpopulation. Then in the 60s, you had the kind of environmental view really coming in strongly. And together, it's a toxic mix and leading to a very, very important and influential ideology, which remains so today in the United States and among many well-meaning people as well, I should say. Kind of a misunderstanding of the role of, a very simplistic understanding of the kind of people versus nature, that people are necessarily bad and that, you know, women having too many babies, especially women of color having too many babies in the global south is what's causing, is ruining nature, you know, and causing scarcity. And not looking at the complex interactions between people and nature, and which people are destroying nature. You know, what about the role of people who are actually protecting nature, conserving resources, peasants terracing the land? So this kind of dark view of human nature, and especially dark view of people of color in countries with high fertility. And as we know, fertility tends to drop as development and urbanization and education proceed. So it's no mystery why birth rates come down. And in the 1990s, in the kind of international security world, there started to be a lot of attention focused on overpopulation supposedly causing resource scarcity, which supposedly then caused war and political violence, especially as people, poor people, migrated from their already degraded lands into cities and became youth bulges of angry young men, et cetera, et cetera. You can kind of trace these narratives, which now are very much present in this kind of climate war discourse. And so it's so easy to kind of it's an easy way to think or not think about really what are these complex interactions. Or we might see those complex interactions in our own localities. We might understand who's doing the most environmental damage in a particular city, like the big toxic coal refinery, you know, or the oil refinery, or, you know, who's preventing solar panels from being built and those kinds of things. But then Americans tend to project this overpopulation lens onto the rest of the world, especially the rest of the global south, and see that scarcity and resource degradation, they tend to think, oh, it's all those people over there. And moreover, those people will probably come to get what we have, and therefore we will, you know, we will face scarcity. There's this incredible fear of scarcity in this country, which is ironic given that we're really one of the most abundant countries on earth. So, and these kinds of ideas, you know, are taught in American schools, they're taught in high schools, they're on AP exams, they're, you know, in environmental studies, and you read some of these textbooks, and people are taught that, you know, it's people versus resources, and rapid population growth means less resources. And there's kind of not a very close attention paid to the role of technological change, for example, or institutional change and how that mediates between human and nature relations. And it's kind of a gloom and doom picture, and with a very easy solution, supposedly, oh, if those people just take contraceptives, you know, if those women just start using contraceptives and have smaller families, then everything will be put right. And it's often presented in this kind of win-win, you know, it's going to be women should get empowered, be able to use contraceptives, and then everything's going to be put right. And, you know, I'm all for everybody having access to contraception and safe abortion services and reproductive health care. Absolutely. But that's not the solution for major environmental and social and political problems. I mean, it's really vital for women's bodily integrity and their health and their family's health to have access to reproductive health care and contraception. But the idea that that's going to solve all these social and environmental problems is really, really, it's a deeply held belief, but it's deeply, deeply problematic.
Do you think this is indicative of something, and all of this apocalyptic thinking, in fact, speaks to the lack of a prevalence of a radical critique of inequality and the way that inequality relates to how we see nature. I mean, not that there hasn't been apocalyptic thinking on the left in the United States and elsewhere, but what you're describing is a kind of environmentalism on the cheap, where the issues that people see, you know, obviously people have absolutely legitimate concern about nature, and absolutely legitimate concern about resource depletion and so on. But then the way that people tend to understand these issues is so simplistic and strips out all the inequalities that help structure the way that nature is used or not used, or, you know, who has an effect on it or not. It seems like that so much of what you're talking about describes a way of seeing all of the roiling dislocations of the world we live in without really getting a handle on them.
Absolutely. And again, I think this goes back to our provincialism and also the lack of exposure to, you know, world history, to environmental history, to history in other places, including, you know, in history, you know, within our country. You know, for example, the wilderness ethic, the idea that, you know, the West was this great wilderness and that we had a right to conquer it and then protect it, not realizing that, you know, protecting so-called pristine nature often meant like kicking out the Native Americans or the Mexican Americans who had lived there for years. So we don't even know our own history of kind of environmental racism among some of the, you know, great, supposedly great thinkers of our times. So, you know, if you look at things with a different lens, I mean, I think it's so important for people to put on, you know, glasses that show inequality, that show political economy, that show who are the, you know, that it's not just a question of, for example, of human beings overshooting carrying capacity, you know, what's happening in a particular area? What are the outside forces? What is the role of the military to an environmental devastation? What is the role of war? That's often left out, you know, of the conversation, especially here in the United States. And, you know, of course, ironically, the Pentagon happens to be the biggest user of transportation fuel in the world. So one of, you know, one of the big carbon culprits. And yeah, so yes, and I think if we assume that things are more complicated, if we can get over, partly Americans are often taught that, again, as part of, I don't know if it's exactly apocalyptic thinking, but in a certain way, millennial thinking, that we also can make it, we can be great because we're Americans, you know, and not seeing the kind of that it's impossible for lots of people to make it. You know, this can be a very cruel culture that way too, that there's not much sympathy for the underdog. And so we can kind of always believe, or, you know, those of us who have resources can believe that, you know, we're somehow going to make it, that we're special, that we have a chosen role, without looking at what's really going on around us and what, you know, why do we have resources and why do other people not have them? But it's not their fault. I mean, one thing about this America syndrome thing is we tend to believe that, you know, we're the victims, right? I mean, even if we're the perpetrators, we tend to believe we're the victims. Americans, I think, you know, like to wallow in victimhood in a way and not look at, you know, okay, who's perpetrating what on whom? Who are the real victims in these situations? And what are people doing to fight back?
Betsy Cartman is my guest. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. Seven Stories Press is the publisher, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I wonder if you could say a bit more about how nature has been seen through the lens of what you're calling the America Syndrome, but an apocalyptic outlook that couples American exceptionalism with a belief that the end is coming, and also linked to expansion and war.
Right. Well, you know, I describe, you know, in the book, I say there are kind of seven deadly synergies that are part of this America syndrome. And one of them, and I think it's a very important one, is nature is kind of a fractured mirror. And so we have kind of these conflicting views of nature, but they kind of merge together. One is that, you know, nature is this pristine wilderness, again, where people never inhabited it, you know. For example, that Native Americans were kicked out of, Yosemite, even though they actually, you know, Native Americans had made that area so beautiful. So nature is pristine, or nature is to be conquered and used as an economic resource, you know, to fuel the great America, you know, economic machine. So that's another view of nature, of course. And, or nature as kind of a sublime escape, you know, and the famous Puritan theologian Jonathan Edwards used to find kind of solace and religious inspiration in nature. So nature is kind of, God's gift to us. It's where we are redeemed, is another view. And then kind of reading nature like the Book of Revelation that, it's going to be destroyed. It is being destroyed. It's the end of the world. And kind of this bleak view. And so often those kinds of views coexist in our minds, I believe, and leads to kind of, I don't know, an uneasiness and a kind of lack of historical understanding of our relationship with the land. Of course, you know, when the Puritans came over, Native Americans, many had died previously from, you know, European diseases. And so this idea that we live in an unoccupied land, the Puritans came and found fewer people than would have been there had, you know, there not been contact with the Europeans. So this idea that we have this kind of vast empty space and I should add to that, and I talk about this in the book, the role of kind of the frontier, you know, that we chase the frontier across the country, and then the frontier, you know, we reach the end of the frontier, and that leads to kind of fears of scarcity. And in the process of, you know, exploring the frontier or conquering the frontier, of course, there's major genocide against Native Americans and Mexicans and not facing up to that reality. And I think people are always like the bottom line, reaching the frontier, the bottom line, this fear of scarcity, you know, that, you know, you're also, there's not a safety net in this country to speak of. And so you're going to reach the end of your bank account. And then where will you go? Like, you know, the frontier has been reached. The bottom has been dropped out. There's scarcity. And it leads to a lot of fear. And sometimes I wonder if Europeans, and this perhaps is a gross exaggeration, but especially those who live in more solid kind of social welfare states, if they're less inclined to be apocalyptic because they have a social support system, the bottom is not going to drop out. There's not going to be scarcity, you know, especially if you have access to healthcare, single payer system, and you know health is a basic right and you're going to receive it for the rest of your life. What does that do to your psychology? So I think the frontiers, both environmental, psychological, economic, kind of mixed together and, leading to this profound fear of scarcity.
Well, it's interesting because the way that people, Americans, tend to even think about how they will deal with these scenarios, these doomsday scenarios, is very individualistic, not surprisingly. And so there is a whole booming industry, in fact, in different kinds of ways of coping with the end times, you know, whether, and I guess it fits people's place on the class hierarchy, whether, you know, you're going to go into the woods with your guns and camp out, or those people who, the wealthy who plan to just relocate somewhere else, whether it's to the South Pacific or New Zealand, where they expect to sort of ride out the coming apocalypse.
Yeah. Yes. And of course, one of the ironies is some of those rich people they're making condos in old bomb silos, you know, nuclear bomb silos, you know. For me, that's one of the great ironies of the age. Yeah. So this idea that you escape individually or, you know, with a small community, and you don't stand together to actually create the kind of social changes that would lead to a better life for you and for everyone around you, you know, it's a sad commentary. I think that we have such a strong survivalist movement, and again, that also goes back to this idea of the rugged pioneer on the frontier, right? You know, that kind of the rugged American ideal, which is predicated on violence, actually. And of course, a lot of the people who are into survivalism, not all of them, but are very much into guns too. Like, you know, got to protect our territory, you know.
And while that conjures up images of the right, you can also see strains of that amongst progressives and the left too. Reading your book made me think of the millennium bug, Y2K, how when clocks and machines had to switch from 1999 to the year 2000, there was a fear amongst people on the right, and it seeped into the progressive sphere, and people didn't really question it very much, that everything was going to melt down, industrial society would melt down, and people ran out and bought Bunsen burners, and there was a kind of a panic.
Yeah, I remember that, you know. And interesting, like one population group did a kind of Y2K thing, you know, that the world population was passing the 6 billion mark, and it was going to be as much of kind of an apocalyptic, you know, event as this computer meltdown. Yeah, no, and I think, you know, this apocalyptic syndrome is not just a right-wing phenomenon, for sure. And, you know, I partly wrote this book because I was very, you know, affected by survivalism myself, not of the kind of gun-toting variety, but, you know, it infects all of us, I think. Maybe not all of us, but in some way, you know, and it's important to see that and try to understand it in yourself. I think it opens new horizons, actually, to be able to look at the future in a not in a kind of Pollyannish way, but in a more considered way.
Well, what are the political implications looking back at the 60s and 70s, looking at today in getting entangled in a sort of apocalyptical outlook, no matter how bad society may in fact be? You know, it's quite a struggle, in effect, not to resist the pull of the apocalyptic when you see major cities flooded out over and over again, these catastrophes in the wealthiest country on Earth. So it's hard not to resist that pull. But, you know, looking back to the late 60s, the early 1970s, when people really were fearing an apocalypse, a lot of, it seems like at least some number of people withdrew from political action or direct political action anyway, and went into personal or small group retreats, whether it was sort of back to the land or so on, and withdrew. What do you see the political implications of this kind of outlook for the left today?
Certainly, the Back to the Land movement was complicated, and there was a tendency for escapism and survivalism, but there was also, you know, many people who did the Back to the Land thing ended up, you know, staying in those areas and getting involved in, making a livelihood, getting involved in politics, et cetera. So it wasn't all escapism, or let's put it this way, sometimes the escapism led to actually more engagement. In general, I think there was a lack of kind of good race, class, gender politics in many of the kind of, in much of the communal movement, and also a failure to see kind of the millennial aspects, and also the kind of repeat of this kind of pioneer myth. Today, you know, I have to say, you know, I've had a lot of students involved in, you know, alternative agriculture, and there seems to be much more of a critical lens in terms of, you know, building food sovereignty, building, you know, getting people in urban areas, poor people, greater access to food, good healthy food, the kind of urban farm projects you see, for example, in neighboring Holyoke here in Massachusetts, are really do a wide range of activities. And so I'm kind of hopeful that I think we do need to develop an alternative agriculture, especially in an era of climate change, an alternative food system, less intensive fossil fuel use in agriculture, so that there are lots of possibilities. You don't want to say no to utopian experimentation, but the more practical it can be, the more engaged it can be, the more critical it can be, and the more it deals with issues of inequality, like you mentioned before, I think the less it will be kind of a survivalist movement and more of a real movement that helps, helps change the country. So I'm excited about that, actually. And I think, people working on climate justice, environmental justice, there's so many good things going on, too. And one thing I would just say about the whole Trump thing and this apocalyptic moment, and especially, his climate denialism making it even worse. I was really felt very apocalyptic after the election myself, but it's just been so heartening to see all the political activism, rising up against the Trump administration, against the white supremacists. And also for, creating sound climate policy. So there's a sense that, actually people are really energized. And I think that energy is one of the best kind of antidotes to apocalyptic despair. Because if you're energetic and you get involved and you get engaged in political action, in fighting back, but also in creating new institutions, new ways of living, I think you just tend to be less prone to despair and more prone to hope, not in a naive sense, but, people do solve problems, and collective action can solve problems. And I think we should not forget that. And individual solutions really don't go very far, and we need to really rebuild community and move forward.
Well, that's a pretty hopeful note, so let's end right there. I've been speaking with Betsy Hartman. She is the author of The America Syndrome, Apocalypse, War, and Our Call to Greatness. That's published by Seven Stories Press. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. Her other books include Reproductive Rights and Wrongs, and she's Professor Emerita of Development Studies and Senior Policy Analyst of the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College. Betsy, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you, Sasha.
And you've been listening to Against the Grain. My name is Sasha Lilly. Thanks for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.